Given this inflection point, we really felt like the time was right. The moment was now for a big push to try to advance floating offshore wind as part of our clean energy future.
Offshore energy. It's not all oil rigs. It's Tuesday, December 6th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, as we're following the World Cup, we're also taking a look at women's tackle football, aka American football, which is having a moment in Europe. And a new documentary exposes widespread abuse at a Mexican megachurch. But first, what's 500 feet high and floating off the coast of California? Well, nothing yet. But today, dozens of companies are bidding in a federal auction for a chance to build a floating wind farm off the coast of Morro Bay in Central California. Offshore wind is big in Europe, but is just getting going here in the U.S. and hasn't made a splash at all on the West Coast. So to answer a few of our questions about it, we've called up David Hochschild. He's chair of the California Energy Commission, and here's his conversation with Scott Tong.
So the ocean near you is more than 4,000 feet deep, so it's too deep to stick turbines on the ocean floor, as I understand it. How does a floating wind turbine work?
Well, so the way these systems work, it's a tripod-based foundation that has a ballast, and the turbine rests on that foundation. I've had the opportunity to see these projects, floating offshore wind installations in both Portugal and Scotland, and I can tell you, you can't actually tell that it's floating. It's tethered to the seafloor with three high-tension cables, so it's actually very steady, sort of similar to how oil rigs are set up. And we're going to be deploying these in these offshore wind zones, which begin about 20 miles off the coast of California.
Yeah, now, these are huge projects that energy companies, they would have to bid at auction, win the auction, get approval from the energy department, assess any ecological damage, on and on. It could be years before any electrons get sent to California homes or California cars. Doesn't California have more proven, cheaper sources of renewable energy? Solar, onshore wind, hydroelectricity?
Well, we do have all those sources and geothermal and energy storage as well. However, what we're doing right now is what I'd call the electrification of almost everything. We're adding about 1,000 electric vehicles a day to the roads in California. Electric demand is growing. And we do need offshore wind to get to 100% clean energy portfolio, which is state law. So one of the things I'm really excited about is that offshore wind technology fits in beautifully to the existing energy portfolio. So it's actually ramping up its generation during the time of day and the time of year when we need it most. Solar production tends to go down late afternoons, early evening, and offshore wind is very strong at that time. And as you know, in September, we had a real challenge to the electric grid with an extended heat storm that lasted 8 days. We did an analysis of what offshore wind would have produced during those hours, and it was at full production, particularly in the North Coast. So it's a really valuable resource for that reason as well.
Now, by some measures, one unit of energy from a floating offshore wind farm, you know, 1 megawatt hour, costs about $200 to produce. It's about 7 times more than a big solar farm or an onshore wind farm. Who pays for this more expensive power? Is it consumers?
Well, to be clear, those prices you mentioned are from the early installations. The current price is about a quarter of that for the large-scale projects that we're seeing in Europe. And so one of the things that happens when you build at scale is you drive the cost down. And one exciting thing with this technology is that the turbines are getting bigger and bigger. We started working on this 8 years ago, and the largest turbine on the market was 7 megawatts. Today, there's a 15-megawatt turbine, and we're on track to very soon have a 20-megawatt turbine, and that's going to help drive costs down as well as you get to larger and larger scale. The other thing I would mention, just so folks have a sense of how much power comes off of these, one rotation of one of these offshore wind turbines powers a house for a day, and they're rotating. It's about 15 rotations a minute, just to give you a sense of the production off of the facility.
Well, you know, I was walking next to a giant offshore wind turbine blade in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and it took me 43 seconds. I timed it to walk from end to end of one blade. I mean, it's huge. I guess my question for you before we let you go is, how proven is this floating technology? I understand you mentioned it's happening in Portugal off of Scotland, but not at this scale, right?
So, yeah, the offshore wind industry is a mature industry and is, you know, Europe is adding about 5 gigawatts a year. And so that's enough power to, say, power 5 San Franciscos a year. The floating element of the offshore wind industry is still small but growing quickly. And there's nothing about the science of doing these structures that's actually that different than anything we've done before. If you look at how oil rigs are installed,
it's basically
the
same. Yeah, sorry to cut you off, sir. Yeah. David Hochschild chairs the California Energy Commission. Thank you so much for the time.
Happy to be with you.
After the break, what's it like to be a European lover of American football? We'll ask the center for the Dutch Lightning. Coming up. The World Cup is in full swing, of course, but enough talk about football. Let's talk football.
Nice catch by number 17. She's driving along, and with that second effort, she gets the first down.
That was commentary from a game between the Dutch Lightning and the Norwegian Trolls, two of the more than 200 women's tackle football teams in Europe. And they recently wrapped up a major tournament, so we thought we'd check back in with Michelle de Boer, center for the Dutch Lightning. Here's her conversation with Deepa Fernandez.
So we spoke late November, and that was ahead of your country's league final. This time you headed to Sweden for an international tournament with teams from 6 countries, 2 days of back-to-back games. What was that like?
It was an amazing experience. It was exhausting. But we learned so much and we had so much fun. So it was really an amazing weekend.
So represented there, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Switzerland, Germany and the Netherlands, all playing American football, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So tell me some of the most exciting moments from the games.
The most amazing thing was to be there with all women, all girls, and just play the game that we all love. And to play against other nationalities and other teams from other countries. So that was amazing. Yeah.
Okay. Don't keep me in suspense any longer. So how did it go? How did your team do?
I think we did okay as a combined team from 4 different teams in the Netherlands. We only had 2 practices before we went to this tournament together. And we won the one game. So that's amazing.
Great.
We had 1 tie and we lost 4 games.
So you went with a combined team from players all over the Dutch league. What was it like turning around and playing with your former rivals after you just competed against them?
To be honest, it was really, really nice. Of course, the first week we were each other's rivals and the other week we played with each other for the Dutch team. And that made us even more stronger together and just one part of one big family. And that was really nice. Yeah. No rivalry at all.
Okay. Tell me, Michelle, why American football? Why are so many women across Europe playing American tackle football?
Well, I think because it is an amazing sport. It's not only really physical, but it's also really strategical that you have to be to score a touchdown. And just the level of physicality that you need is just amazing. And it's a tough game, but it's also a really respectful game. So that's very nice to play as well.
We only have a few seconds left, but after this big tournament in Sweden, do you think it's a sign that the sport is going to just keep growing there, particularly in Northern Europe?
Absolutely. Compared to what we have in the Netherlands, in the Scandinavian countries, it's already very big. And so I just hope that it grows bigger and bigger and that we can compare it with the level that it is on the States right now.
That's Michelle de Boer, American tackle football player for the Dutch Lightning. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you, Deepa, for having me.
And go Dutch Lightning.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely.
Coming up next, Deepa speaks with the director of a new documentary series investigating allegations of widespread abuse at the Mexican megachurch La Luz del Mundo. Stick around.
La Luz del Mundo, or The Light of the World, is a Christian megachurch founded in Mexico. They claim to have over 5 million followers. But according to a new documentary series unveiled, La Luz del Mundo has also been the center of horrifying sexual abuse that victims say was perpetrated by the church leaders.
Think about all the other little girls that have gone through this. What do all those other little girls that haven't been identified as victims, that their parents don't know, or that they are just simply afraid? They're scared. So it's for them that I speak up today.
Unveiled premieres on HBO and HBO Max tonight. Jennifer Teixeira is the director of the series, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer, the story you tell may be unfamiliar to some listeners, so can we start off with kind of an overview about La Luz del Mundo? It was founded in Guadalajara in Mexico, 1926, and the leader of the church is called the Apostle. And since 1926, those leaders, three men, Aaron, Samuel, and Nason, have been three generations of the same family. Can you give us an idea of the power these men wield?
Yeah, absolutely. The apostle is the representation of God here on earth. And so the power that they wield is extreme. The members believe that that's the direct connection to God himself.
We mentioned they have 5 million followers worldwide. That's a lot.
They claim 5 million members worldwide, but we really don't know those numbers. We do know that they're located in over 50 countries and that they're here in 50 states. Just within a 10-mile radius here in Los Angeles, I'm surrounded by four of them. So it's really extraordinary how this has kind of been happening in our backyard and under our nose.
Your film centers around a woman named Xochitl Martin. Tell us a little about her.
Xochitl, like our other survivors, was born here in the United States, an American citizen. She's fourth or fifth generation, actually, La Luz del Mundo. A lot of our survivors are fourth or fifth generation. And it's pretty extraordinary how she grew up here, went to school in East LA, a very famous high school, John Marshall High School, but was also a member of this church and a victim of not only Samuel, but his son, Nason.
So Xochitl tells us what happened to her when she was in her early teens. She was chosen for special duties involving the apostle. What were those duties that she and other young women were asked to perform?
It's all kind of disguised under the word of a blessing. And these blessings, when the apostle calls on you, it's an extraordinary honor. What makes it so complicated is the multi-generational abuse that's happened. In these cases, in Social's case in particular, her mom was also groomed and abused, and so was her aunt. Usually in the beginning, it's working in the apostle's home, serving him meals, cleaning, things of that nature. And then there's these dances. The dances are usually public in the beginning, and they're for like all the members and the family. And then you get asked to do the private dances for the apostle. And that's where the abuse really starts to develop. What was so extraordinary in these cases is we had women in their 60s, 50s, 40s, and 20s. All of their stories were almost interchangeable.
And as you pointed out earlier, through Xochitl's case, you know, in some ways, such a regular life, kind of a church-going girl from East LA, yet she was basically being asked to hold this big secret, being told because the apostles have a direct line to God that, you know, whatever they're asked to do, if it feels wrong, that it couldn't be wrong because it was God asking them to do it. So this girl who's going to school and participating in life alongside everybody else there in Los Angeles is actually being serially abused, right?
That's exactly right. It's just this insane power imbalance, right? This abuse of power. But in this case, this idea of eternal salvation, and it's not just their eternal salvation. It's the eternal salvation of their parents, of their siblings, of everybody in the world that they care about. And that's just a lot to carry. I mean, as an adult, let alone a young girl or boy, that you're responsible.
How widespread was this kind of abuse? Because we see in your film particularly that, you know, a certain number came forward. But we also see these images of just thousands praying and worshiping and crying and like just so deeply into the faith. Do you know how widespread the abuse was? Was it just this little cadre of women?
A lot of survivors have been coming forward. I know with the subreddit, which is a huge part of this story, it's where a lot of our survivors first found each other anonymously and then joined this friendship. And the series was the first time almost all of them are telling their story, besides social. It's really tricky, right? Because I have met a lot of members who are, you know, had no idea this was going on and are wonderful people. You know, and as in any religion, there is this sense of community and beauty. But what's so horrific about this organization is they're really preying on the best part of humanity, not only in the sexual nature, but in a, you know, economic way, in a spiritual abuse way, in a coercive control sort of way. So the sexual abuse is just one part of it.
Jennifer, in your film, La Luz del Mundo asks members to give 10% of their income. And the church is heavily invested in real estate. They buy up property surrounding their physical structures of churches. Can you talk about their influence, particularly in Mexico? And did that influence give them immunity from prosecution?
Absolutely. To understand how deep the roots go, Nason had his birthday party at the Palacio de Bellas Artes in Mexico City. That's the equivalent of a religious leader having a private birthday party, say, at the White House. And basically, the governing bodies in Mexico let this happen because La Luz is so tied to the Mexican authorities, the Mexican government. And those ties go very, very deep.
There was some justice because years and years after this abuse was going on, thanks to women like Xochitl, who actually were brave enough to come forward, because in your film you do point out that, you know, in 1997, when somebody came forward and there was charges of abuse against Samuel, one of the apostles, evidence disappeared and the accuser was attacked, like stabbed 69 times. But fast forward to more recently, there's now a court case against Nason. And he is in Los Angeles, where prosecutors have 36 charges against him, including child pornography, human trafficking, and rape. Yet it kind of doesn't pan out. He takes a plea to three very light charges. What happened?
Nason had a really amazing attorney, and that attorney is known for finding loopholes and accused the prosecution of withholding a certain amount of evidence. And I think the prosecution was ultimately scared that they were going to lose the case altogether in an appeal if they didn't agree to the plea, or if they didn't offer the plea, excuse me.
So ultimately, he accepts a plea offer for 16 years, which he's serving right now. You know, one of the people in your film, an attorney for the Jane Does, she says that this is because of who the victims are, that they're Latina women, they're Spanish-speaking women, some of them, and that had the Jane Does been white, that this wouldn't have happened. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with that. To say that our justice system is colorblind, I don't believe that. And I do think it would have been different. I mean, this arrest happened the same time as Jeffrey Epstein case, NXIVM case, a lot of its counterparts, yet we just, somehow we just missed it. And I do believe it's because of the victims' nationalities.
And the main English-speaking press also seems to have missed this story.
That's right.
Are you hoping that the series will cause other members of La Luz del Mundo who have been silent to come forward?
Absolutely. That's the big hope. And also a federal investigation. Again, this is all 50 states. This is not limited to only California. So we're really hoping that a federal investigation happens and a federal case, that the survivors do get their day in court that they so deserve. 16 years is not enough.
Jennifer Teixeira is the director of a new documentary series, Unveiled, Surviving La Luz del Mundo. It debuts tonight on HBO. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Check out our website, hereandnow.org, for more stories, including how scientists are looking for clues about climate change in the weather logs of 19th century whalers.
So this is the weather from Tuesday, the 20th of January, 1880. First part of the day, wind hauled into the northeast, tacked into the south-southeast, light breeze with thick, hazy weather.
Doesn't sound too different from the weather here in Chicago today. Today's stories were produced by James Mastro Marino, Adeline Sear, and Emiko Tamagawa. Todd Munt and Jill Ryan edited the show. Technical direction today from Max Liebman and Mike Moschetto. Max, Mike, and I wrote the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.